Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We'll begin with a few announcements of our activities, and then we will read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The purpose of the United Lodge of Theosophists, wherever it is located, is to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. The purpose of gaining a fundamental understanding of the basic ideas of the philosophy is so that we can apply them practically in our everyday lives in order to gain a truer realization of the self and a profounder conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. In keeping with this aim and purpose of the Lodge, we here in Philadelphia voluntarily and independently support a few weekly activities. On Sunday mornings from 11 to 12, we present a series of talks on one of the various aspects of the philosophy of Theosophy. Beginning in the month of June, the umbrella topic is practical theosophy. And this week we are taking up the idea of the quieting of the mind and the soothing of the feelings. Next Sunday the subject will be similar with a little bit different emphasis, that of and loving intellect and intelligent heart. We did want to mention that the following Sunday, which would be the 21st, is a special meeting, ULT Day, United Lodge of Theosophists Day, where associates and friends of ULT around the world and the various lodges commemorate the life and work of Robert Crosby, one of the chief founders, if not the chief founder, of the United Lodge of Theosophists back in 1909. And along with that meeting, there will be a talk presented on the United Lodge of Theosophists, its mission and future. On Wednesday evenings, from 7:30 to 8:30, we have a study class. And this season, we've been using The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. We are finishing up the chapter on psychic forces and phenomena. And the subject for this Wednesday evening is specifically that on dreams and apparitions. Now also on Wednesday, we have the library available from 5:15 through 7:15. The purpose of the library is to allow free access to straight line theosophical literature, which you can study. There is always a librarian student there as a volunteer to help you in your research. There are also a variety of supporting books in various disciplines of knowledge that help round out one's independent education in these regards. For those that are interested in individual study, which is very important, on the book table in the center of the building on the first floor here, we have a display of straight-line theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, and magazines, which are available at the cost of publication and shipping. There is no profit made from the sale of these books. The books may be obtained and examined at the book table before and after meetings and during library hours. All of the activities here are conducted by voluntary and independent effort of associates. All are welcome to attend any Effort, no matter how big or small, is greatly needed and appreciated in the lines of time, work, and of course money, which is necessary to keep the building opening and functioning year after year. Having presented those announcements, then we'd like to read to you the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, which contains the principles upon which the United Lodge of Theosophists, wherever it may be found in the world, is based and conducted. This declaration can be found on the back of the yellow periodical that is available at the usher's table. You can pick up a copy for study and reference as you leave. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. It welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. This morning, then, we are going to have for our mutual study and consideration on practical theosophy presentation on quieting the mind, soothing and feelings. Our format today is a panel, so we'll have brief talk first on quieting the mind and then one on soothing the feelings. After that, we'll open it up for your questions, comments, and answers. Friends, quieting the mind and soothing the feelings are very important aspects of practical theosophy, as they lead to equal-mindedness, and that is necessary for devotion to any cause, especially the cause of theosophy. Discipline of the mind and heart are interrelated, they're interdependent, and difficult. So we cannot presume that we are going to present the entire subject in its complexity, or even you're going to walk out of here quite skilled in those areas. But hopefully you'll find a place in which you can comfortably begin this effort. So we'd like to start with a few brief excerpts from two of the devotional books that we use that illustrate these points. And the first one is from the Bhagavad Gita, which we will be studying this summer. So in the sixth chapter, Arjuna partially complains and partially asked his teacher, Krishna, O slayer of Madhu, on account of the restlessness of the mind, I do not perceive any possibility of steady continuance in this yoga of equanimity, which thou hast declared. For indeed, O Krishna, the mind is full of agitation, turbulence, strong and obstinate. I believe the restraint of it to be as difficult as that of the wind. And Krishna responds, without doubt, O thou of mighty arms, the mind is restless and hard to restrain. But it may be restrained, O son of Kunti, by practice and absence of desire. Yet in my opinion, this divine discipline called yoga is very difficult for one who hath not his own soul in his own control. Yet it may be acquired by one who is assiduous and controlleth his heart. Quieting the mind is therefore a particularly important step in the acquiring of self-knowledge and a deeper conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. And to emphasize that, we just like to briefly read a small excerpt from The Voice of the Silence, another devotional book. The pupil must seek out the Raja of the senses, the thought producer, he who awakes illusion. The mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer. When to the world's turmoil thy budding soul lends ear, learn, O disciple, of her silent God, thy soul is an unworthy shrine. So the use of the terms mind and soul mentioned in these two devotional books refer to the lower mind, one of the principles used by the immortal reincarnating ego when the ego incarnates. And so when the ego incarnates, the mind becomes twofold in its appearance, just as there are two sides of a coin representing the one reality of the coin. The lower mind may be studied as to its nature and disciplined according to the dictates of the higher mind. So when we use these terms, lower and higher, they're both important and necessary to us in evolution, in experience on this plane. However, one, the lower, is changeable, fleeting, and temporary. The other, the higher, is steady, constant, and permanent. So, quieting then the lower mind begins with a knowledge of its faculties and action. And in the philosophy, we can easily identify and recognize that the lower mind has five faculties. They are thought, memory, imagination, will or desire, and feeling. And as these latter two, desire and feeling, have more to do with the heart faculties of the lower mind, they will be the focus of the presentation that follows this one. So thought then is the power to produce, reproduce, and regenerate ideas. Memory is the power to store and reproduce past impressions. And imagination is the power to produce and reproduce images of ideas and memories. As such, these three qualities are creative powers. Quieting them does not mean they are to be eliminated or subdued into inaction. In fact, that's not possible anyway. They are to be restrained, though, and redirected, just as we redirected the horses pulling a chariot, to achieve their full creative potential. Of these three faculties, thought, memory, and imagination, memory is pivotal And it's where we need to begin to make our effort, because memory can be the friend or enemy of the other two and a key to their discipline. So as we look at our lower mind, we see that it has four peculiarities of activity. One we've already touched upon, and Arjuna mentions it. In other words, the mind, because of its natural motion, flies restlessly off from one subject to another. But this is partially due to memory as well. And any of us that have tried to concentrate or meditate on a single line of thought or inquiry know that as soon as we do that, the memory brings forth all sorts of impressions that are a distraction to meditation. The second faculty of mind is that it flies off to some pleasant idea or image, and this is entirely due to the action of memory. There could be some sound or experience, and through associative memory, a pleasant idea comes up or an image from the past, and there goes our mind right after it. And sometimes we don't even have to have a impression that brings up associative memory. Sometimes in our reverie and our silent inner nature, when we're dwelling on things, other memories come up by association, and our mind goes off in daydreaming and fantasizing and all sorts of speculations. So we also know that the mind also flies off to unpleasant ideas or images, which is also due to memory, the reproduction of past ideas. And in this regard, we see the mind embroiled in guilt or remorse or fear and anxiety about the future. The fourth peculiarity of motion, and we use that term interestingly, is that the mind is passive or apparently inactive in consideration of anything. It can be a natural or a forced attempt to keep the mind from considering anything. And when this happens naturally, of course, we go to sleep. And people who cannot sleep will very often tell you they cannot turn off their minds. There's this constant reproduction of memories and fears, just keeps them awake or wakes them up in the middle of the night. When this passivity or inactivity is uncontrolled, it can lead to a passivity that is psychically sensitive and producing of a mental imbalance. So these three four peculiarities of the activity of mind, these are the things that have to be quieted, not the activity of the mind itself. The key to this proper quieting the mind is using the recollective power of memory, using memory to keep before the thought and the imagination of the mind the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, in order that the mind can harness all its natural creative power of thought and imagination and make these ideas creative powers in the affairs of our life. Now, of course, there are many different applications and we can go into and practices, but the basic ideas are now presented, and we'll turn it over to now a consideration of soothing the feelings.
The first thing that we thought of in this regard is that with all the self-help books in all the bookstores, and with the internet, with all the blogs, with all the quotes and recommendations, we're never far from advice about how to soothe or control the feelings. And maybe we can even quote them. But slogans do not produce the practice. So what we carry around are recommendations. We still don't know how to do it. what are some of these modern quotes we see everywhere? The mind is everything. What you think, you become. With our thoughts, we make the world. He is able who thinks he is able. You will not be punished for your anger. You will be punished by your anger. Holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one who gets burned. Wonderful wisdom of our modern world, right? But it isn't modern. These are quotes from the teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha was teaching on the basis of a way of life, a way of living, thinking, and acting, as we just heard, in control of the mind and the feelings. It is a struggle, but it is the struggle of the soul in evolution. It's what we're here to do. But to go from, is it an obstacle or an opportunity, to realizing, oh, losing my job just now is a wonderful opportunity because I can find something more meaningful to do. That is almost impossible for us. So the first recognition we have to come to is we are spiritual beings, using our powers in life to learn about our powers, to learn about our real nature, and to participate in the sharing of what we learn with all of life. And as to calming or soothing our feelings, we already know how to do it. We do it all the time. We just don't recognize that we're doing it. An example, you're walking along on the sidewalk in Center City, and someone on a bicycle almost knocks you over. You are furious. How dare people behave like that? And in your anger, you look ahead, and someone has just been knocked over by that cyclist who didn't even stop. And you and the people around you rush to help the person who's been knocked down. Where is your anger? It's gone. Why is it gone? Because it's been replaced. Replaced by concern for someone else, replaced by a completely different action. Well, was it real then? Could it be real if it can just disappear? How can we replace something if it is real on its own? When we begin to really look, and if we would watch ourselves for one day and watch how our feelings jump from one thing to another, whether it's in anticipation of something that we're concerned about or hopeful about something, if we would begin to watch that it's we who are in charge. We decide what we will feel. It doesn't seem that way. It really seems like the feeling controls us. But, and we've often used this example, if you have a terrible feeling, a fear of something, and it's just controlling your every moment of thought, what if you drop something on your foot? Fear is gone. All you are now is pain and complaining. So there are so many examples. If we would stop and look at it, our mind is ours. We're in charge of it, but it's our use is to just let it run away with us. So we have to return to the basis from which the great souls have always taught. The three fundamentals were mentioned, and they are very basically that all life is one from a universal principle, not a being. The source of life is a principle, and all life is one with it. And that the action of that life is under law, the law of cycles, of periodicity. So for a human, we have reincarnation and karma, set up causes, and the cycle will bring you back to face the results. And the whole purpose of all of this activity is evolution, growth from within, no one imposing anything. So we can replace any feeling that we hold just by deciding to. Take a week and prove that to yourself, and your life will never be the same. You will not be controlled by your feelings. You may be mistaken often and have the wrong feeling, but at least you know you're in charge of it. Now, there are some recommendations in the Theosophical Writings of Robert Crosby that sound very simple, but they're challenging. Try them. Begin with the small things. Don't let yourself be annoyed by them. Never speak nor write if the slightest trace of irritation remains. Wait. Or if speaking or writing is necessary, take some subject which permits of accord. Take everything that comes as a matter of course, as it really is law. So the feeling we have to learn to have is this difficulty, this problem, this miserable thing that I'm facing is mine. It came under the law of my own spiritual being. Back to quoting, the quality of inner thoughts and feelings reflects in the external environment. And that is why running away will not enable a person to escape his own self-made destiny. You take yourself with you and your karma with you. The change must be an inner one, a change of heart, a new orientation of mind. In other words, a change of attitude. We own our attitude. And to come full circle from the start of this presentation, here is a truly modern suggestion from a current blog by someone named Michael Hyatt. And it's simplified, and because it is simplified, like Epictetus, it helps us see ourselves. He says, I have a task. I have to speak on a panel. Wait, I don't have to speak. I get to speak. That instantly changes my attitude. I have to do it is the language of duty, and there's nothing wrong with that. But too often we say it with a sigh, like, I am a victim. But I get to do it is the language of privilege. It's as if we have been given a gift and we're relishing the opportunity. And then he gives three bits of advice. Become aware of your vocabulary, the difference between try and do. That's Yoda, isn't it? Become aware of the words you are using. 2, start using get to rather than have to. Start intentionally using the language of privilege rather than duty. I have to mop the kitchen floor. No, I get to. Not only do I have a kitchen floor, but I have a mop. And I have things that end up making it dirty, which means it's an active living place. I get to wash the kitchen floor. 3, notice the difference it makes in your attitude. Rather than dreading or resenting an activity, you can be thankful for it. If only every morning we woke up and went through the privileges that we have. We have fresh water, how much of the world does not? We have spiritual wisdom in books. How many lives do we imagine we starved for it and begged for it, and now it's everywhere we look? We'd like to end with, well, of course we can't end this subject, but we'd like to stop talking with two quotes. One from Viktor Frankl, if you will recall, amazing soul who lived through the concentration camps and wrote afterwards. And if you can read any of his writings, do so. He said, "Everything can be taken from a man or a woman but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances." And he said he realized this and wrote this because of the fellow prisoners who would go around sharing their food or making someone feel better, who used their will and their time to care about those around them. And then for us, just as practical things, from H.P. Blavatsky, "For after all is said and done, the purely bodily actions and functions are of far less importance than what a man thinks and feels, what desires he encourages in his mind and allows to take root and grow there. And that we can control." Your response is, of course, invited. Yes. Well, it is a beautiful piece of fiction, and a lot of Holocaust victims resented the premise because it didn't happen that way. But at the same time, it taught a beautiful lesson. The father never let the child be part of the selection to be carried away. He told him, "We're playing a game, and the game is you have to stay hidden. You must never let anyone know you're here except when you're with me." And it's a wonderful, moving story of love, of real love. And there was such, as Frankl's writing proves, there was such in the camps. It's a question of will, of being able to keep yourself as a soul in the midst of that. We don't know if you've ever heard of Pema Chodron. She's a Buddhist monk, I guess you call women who are
nuns.
A Buddhist nun, right? And she wrote, "Welcome the present moment as if you had invited it. It is all we ever have, so we might as well work with it rather than struggling against it. We might as well make it our friend and teacher rather than our enemy. Why are we a slave to our feelings? Because we choose to be, until we don't like them anymore, and then we fight to get rid of them, and take other feelings.
If we start with that idea, soothing the feelings. So when we use this word soothing, in a physical sense, it means we're in pain, we hurt, and we apply some medicine or treatment that eases the pain, the discomfort. So when we say soothing the feelings, it means that we are experiencing an emotion, usually either fear or anger, which hurts. And so soothing one is then learning first how to soothe our own feelings. And as said, realizing that we are spiritual beings and can freely choose and exercise that is a very important step to soothing our feelings. That's part of the emancipation, to realize that we come to realize that they don't control us, we control them. But then how do you soothe the feelings of another or a group of people? How do you quiet the mind of another person or a group of people? So there is a practice in various cultures, very close to nature, that before there is a meeting among them where there might be or is the potential for hurt feelings, for disagreements on the basis of conflicting ideas, they go around the circle and each one talks about what they are grateful for. And it's usually something in nature. The one's grateful for the wind, one's grateful for the fire, one's grateful for the birds. Mm-hmm. By the time they get around, they all realize that they share something in common, their gratitude. And that is something that we can learn from. Any experience that comes to us, especially if it one that hurts, is a lesson, is a learning. The very fact that we are in pain is an indication that we are out of balance. And so we can learn to be grateful for those pains, those sufferings that come to us, whether from others or from ourselves, as an opportunity to learn. And reminding ourselves that we can be grateful from that perspective frees us and frees others to the extent they recognize their gratitude from the hurt feelings and also quiets the mind.
There's also a very practical side to that. If someone is starving, don't give them philosophy. Give them bread. If someone's in deep pain over a loss, don't give them philosophy. Give them a comforting word, a sympathetic feeling. It's not wrong to have feelings of pain and hurt. It is wrong to reject someone else's right to feel that way. It's often said that one of the things that hurts people the most when they've just suffered a great loss is to have someone say, well, the one you loved, at least they're not suffering now. And that really hurts the person who's receiving it. So we have to be very careful how we soothe the feelings of others.
Just to follow up on that, this is why Theosophy emphasizes the importance and power of individual personal charity from one human being to another, rather than through organized charity. Because the gift of one to another, even if it seems small, inspires gratitude in the one who receives it and also helps the one that gives it. And it is that experience of gratitude that is the first thing that soothes the hurt, the feeling, and the despair in the other person, even before they have a chance to apply and use the gift you give them.
Way in the back.
We had a relative say something once that knocked us out. We've never forgotten it. Change the thought and the feeling will follow.
we just read a quote like that. You can't be both awesome and negative, so choose one. Or as a fellow student once said, it's only a feeling, pick another one. Try it. It does work. And everything in your life is a reflection of a choice you have made. If you want a different result, make a different choice. It's so simple, we don't believe it.
The advice is simple.
Yes.
The practice is hard.
Yes.
But why? Because of that nasty little memory, but that powerful friend memory. The feeling of hurt creates an impression. And like everything else in nature, it's subject to the laws of cycles. Open your eyes and stare at a bright light bulb, then close them. The impression of that after image on the retina goes away, comes back, goes away, comes back, until it wears out. If you kept opening your eyes and looking at the light, the harsh light, it would never go away. Same way with our feelings. They make their impression, we subdue them, they come back, we subdue them, and then we get discouraged. It's not working. But if you keep up with it and you not allow your mind to go back to the old feeling but continuously replace it with the new one, a new impression is implanted which becomes more powerful. And by memory, by the power of memory, whenever that old impression tries to sneak back, it brings with it, associated with it, the powerful impression of the new feeling. So it's a way we can use memory and knowledge of cycles to help ourselves.
Mr. Judge gives a recommendation for people who have the blues. If you're depressed, it's going to be a cycle, and you could literally track it. It's going to come every 4 weeks or every 6 weeks. It's a regular cycle, like a weather one, that will return to you. And as was just said, you replace that feeling. But an important thing to do within that struggle and effort is reach out to someone else that you know that needs cheering up or assistance in some way, because that feeling of giving to another will also come back when the depressive cycle comes back, and you're already then on the path to behaving differently. Yes?
Well, we like the word learning how to be alert. For the simple reason that in public, socially, family, and so forth, a red light goes on in your mind when you pay attention to those circumstances where, in groups or so forth, someone desires to be punished by your anger, perhaps. And you become the victim of the circumstances. So alertness means that calmness, and in fact, the first speaker spoke about those qualities of our nature that we should develop: calmness, attention, and right identification of circumstances as they are occurring. And you are in charge of the situation for the benefit of them.
So there's a few things that we can say about alertness. We can assume that we're all alert here, but we're selectively alert. And how many of us are alert through even the use of our physical senses at the dozen or so sounds that are in this room? Or can smell or taste the atmosphere of this room? Or can feel the vibration of it on their skin? Or can immediately capture through their eyes the flow, the blend of colors? We only know those things as we practice selective attention. And in the course of our lives, because our alertness and attention is drawn so much to the duties of life, of just providing for shelter and survival and dealing with the pains and the brief pleasures of the senses, we are not given, unless we discipline ourselves, to becoming aware of our feelings, selectively alert to our feelings, our desires, what makes us tick, and the thoughts that we have that have such an influence on the way we sense and are aware of the world around us. So, yes, we need to be alert, but we want to practice more and more becoming selectively alert. So take one of the ideas heard here and become selectively aware of its value and meaning in your life, the effect it has on your life, the thought and feelings and relationships as you apply that single idea throughout a week. And if you do that, you'll learn more in a week than you could learn in a semester of a course in psychology in college, at least in terms of how your own thoughts and feelings work in you.
And in terms of power, if you realize that you have the power all along, that everything in our lives is created by us as spiritual beings making choices. Once you realize you have that power, what can stop you? Only your own fears and insecurities and your alertness to the things that aren't important to you. So it's, well, as that blogger said, it's a privilege, not a duty. We have the whole world in front of us. And we have the ability, if we're willing to be alert to our real nature, to change ourselves, our quality of mind, our quality of feelings. And in doing that, I think it's James Allen. No, it's Annie Payson Call. You can find her works online. She wrote in the last century. If each individual soul would do his own work, would in himself work with an alert desire to know the laws of spirit and to obey them, if each individual would get the habit of looking entirely to himself for the cause of suffering in himself and would refuse to compromise in any slightest way, the gain in spiritual health that would come to the world would be wonderful. In other words, you heal yourself, you heal your community. Heal your community, you heal your nation. We are a cell in a body called humanity. And as we heal, we affect the whole. In the back. We're laughing because Mr. Judge says one of the difficult karmas that we as humans in this cycle have is we don't know our duty. So all we can do in that process is look at what we see should be done and needs to be done and honor it to the best of our ability. If we begin to clear up our feelings and quiet our mind, we will be able to see some of what is our natural duty.
So here's part of the problem. So much has materialism infected our thinking as a civilization that even our sense and understanding of duty is materialistic, because we define our duties as what's outside there in the physical world. How much money I have to make, how much food I have to put on the table, the work I have to do, the lessons I have to learn, the grades I have to make, all that. Or we define it into what people out there tell us we need to do, other physical beings. Whereas the real spiritual sense of duty in the East would really be along the line of what's called dharma, or the natural spiritual duty. So if we think of a human being as essentially a spiritual being, a mind being, what is the natural duty, the inner duty of such a being in any situation? It's the duty to think, to feel, to act from a spiritual point of view. And that we can do in any circumstance. And as long as we're doing it, we are performing our duty. We cannot fail to perform what's right for ourselves and what's right for others.
Yes.
Yes.
The whole talk is going to remind me of that great book that we'll be starting shortly, the Bhagavad Gita, the symbolism of the two armies facing one another, and Arjuna in the center, and he's looking at what we are told by his cousins and his uncles and his friends and his family, but the symbolic part of it is that he's looking at habits, inherited habits and prejudices and preferences that he has to attack and get rid of in order to win this battle, which is what we all face. So it wakes up in us, maybe takes it out of the box and shines up our ability to choose and sets it down in front of us again, not to blindly accept all these things that we've inherited from society, from our families, from our nation, from our world, and to really look at them for ourselves, to really examine them one at a time and make the changes necessary to make. So it's very good talk, very good topic, and I was surprised at how you brought it to us. Thank you.
You know, the most difficult thing in the world is to sit down and look at yourself in the way that you're saying. On one side of the page, all of the things that I know. And then on the other, all of the things that I think I know because somebody told me and I trust them. And then to realize what you have to do is get everything from the right side of the page to the left or get rid of it. And that means that maybe 3/4 of what we accept as reality is not real. It is only real in the physical world. In the spiritual world, the idea is completely different from what we think. We've always loved the realization that we think when we walk that what we do is we throw our foot and we go forward, that we're sort of falling forward. That isn't it at all. We put our foot down and the ground pushes us forward. We don't move forward. So we don't even know how we do the physical things that we do. We make assumptions. We've got to look. We've got to look at all of our ideas, our reasons for behaving in a certain way, and inspect them and decide which army they belong to.
Isn't this part of the problem? We say to ourselves, I would like to quiet the mind. I would like to soothe my feelings. I'm just too upset now. So Arjuna is out there in the middle of the battlefield. It's not a quiet scene. It's not the calm before the storm. He's sitting there contemplating the differences in the enemy, but the arrows are already flying. He's in the midst of it while he's having this contemplation. And that's the way our lives are. If we wait till everything's going to be peaceful and subdued next Tuesday to get started, we're missing the opportunity now. So yes, the arrows are flying, but that's the time when, like Arjuna, we can sit back, take the seat of our own silent solitude, our perspective, and look at it from the point of view it is before us, and from the point of view Krishna, our higher self, sees it, and have that little dialogue. How does Krishna see it? How do I see it? How do they see it? And all that goes on, and at the end of that, we take the advice from Krishna, now get up and do the best you can. Do what seems right to you. It's the only way we can act now. It's the only way we can act in the human condition.
Yes.
Interesting, too, that you, about the arrows flying. If whenever you talk to great athletes or great warriors, and they'll tell you, and not just great athletes and warriors, average people, too, when something happens and it's really, you know, life-changing, often you'll hear them say, but it all appeared to be happening in slow motion, where they have separated themselves from the physical and they stand above it and see it happening around them. But it gives them a perspective of power to make choices in infinite amounts of time and change it for the better, or, you know. Yeah.
But the fact is that power is always there. We just don't recognize it. As was said, we're so busy in the material world. We wanted to close with these two quotes. First, by someone we've never heard of. Paul Meyer said, focus on your strengths instead of your weaknesses, on your powers instead of your problems. And then Albert Schweitzer, who wrote many, many wonderful philosophical things, said, the greatest discovery of any generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering the attitudes of their minds. Altering lives by altering the attitude. We can all do that. Meeting is adjourned.